competitiveness in those who enjoy such shows, the country has allocated a whopping 47 million Qatari riyals for the lucky winners. The 45-day event will last until March 22nd and will include various competitions, including 115 local and international races.
In the streets of the Chadian capital city, an actor is bringing culture to impoverished neighborhoods by organizing readings of poetry and plays.
Culture should be accessible to all. If we want to have a wonderful world, a harmonious world, everyone should be focused on the same dimensions to be able to dream together. And without culture, we won't be able to initiate development. And to initiate this stage of development, we need to invite people to think together.
The actor does not have a fixed place to tell his stories. He performs in public spaces and says it is his way of giving everyone the opportunity to discover and explore creativity. Among the activities Bonaventure organizes, one can name drawing with children and conducting acting classes. He believes music and theater bring other disciplines together, creating an avenue for enriching human connections. Residents, especially the children of the impoverished neighborhood, say they always look forward to Bonaventure's arrival. A first-of-its-kind selfie museum in the Central American country of Guatemala is gaining lots of attention from excited enthusiasts. The selfie museum is located in Antigua, Guatemala, and is made up of 40 rooms or scenarios. Each room is a recreation of a colorful theme. Wallpaper, wings, greenery, neon signs, and other props are all present to spark the interest of visitors. One room includes a levitating bed, and another is equipped with a spaceship. Other rooms have familiar scenarios of presidential offices and comic book characters for visitors to take photographs in. Several artists participated in creating the art illustrations. A zoo in Peru's capital city, Lima, is celebrating a rare hatching of endangered baby crocodiles. The Huachipa Zoo showcased three females and one male to the public on the World Wildlife Day. The four crocodiles were born in incubators as part of the conservation efforts for the reptile. This species is an American crocodile, which is on the endangered list of animals in Peru. Zookeepers say the black market and threats on their habitat have seen the crocodile population dwindle. The zoo regularly receives animals that were rescued from trafficking. Among those traits are tortoises, macaws, and monkeys.
The 2022 World Cup is reaching a fever pitch as hundreds of people line up at a shopping center in Qatar to take a picture with a trophy. The famous Golden World Cup trophy was unveiled during a ceremony at a mall in Doha, where excited football fans waited for their turn to see it. They were also given the option to take a selfie or have their photo taken professionally. While the competition is still nearly a year away, FIFA says more than a million tickets were requested within the first 24 hours after sales opened. The highest demand came from fans from Qatar, followed by Argentina, Mexico, and the United States, among others. Bangladesh is reviving the ancient tradition of producing a historically renowned fine hand-woven fabric called muslin. With the help of the government, the trade is making a comeback. Now, a workshop has been set up in Dhaka, where weavers are being trained in the ancient art. They say it took them months to master the craft, working with incredibly fine hand-spun cotton yarns. The weavers say it takes them 8 hours to spin just 4 centimeters. Some varieties of the fabric are so fine that an entire muslin sari could fit inside a single matchbox.
There was a myth about muslin that it was so delicate that it would pass through even a small ring. Look, it's true. There is space to squeeze in another piece of cloth through this ring as well.
Breathing life back into this ancient trade was not easy. Officials with a revival project say there was little knowledge about how this fabric was made. Plus, the rare cotton variant, which makes this fabric so expensive, was also lost. The precious fabric was the most extravagant of its era and popular in Mongol courts. It was also imported into Europe for much of the 17th century and transformed the style of the aristocracy there.
An art gallery in London, Tate Modern, is hosting an exhibition with a remarkable span of surrealist works. The exhibition, dubbed Surrealism Beyond Borders, features more than 170 artworks ranging from paintings and sculptures to photography and films. Works by more than 150 artists from over 60 years are on the display. The exhibit also has a wide geographical span and includes surrealist artworks from different countries. Some of the most prominent artists whose works are being exhibited include Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, and Ted Jones. The exhibition will run until August 9th.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Following Russia's claims that the United States is financing biological weapons laboratories in Ukraine, an allegation the US calls disinformation, China is now getting involved in the verbal sparring between Moscow and Washington by repeating the same talking points and calling on the US to prove the rumors are false. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Patricia McKnight. The piece is titled, China calls on US to clarify rumor of alleged biological weapons. In Chinese state-run media, a spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry urged American leaders to provide thorough clarification regarding any biological military activities that the United States is doing in Ukraine. Following Russia's claim that the U.S. is financing biological weapons laboratories in Ukraine, an allegation the U.S. calls disinformation, China is now getting involved in the verbal sparring between Moscow and Washington by repeating the same talking points and calling on the US to prove the rumors are false. This will help restore the international community's confidence in the US fulfillment of its international obligations and strengthen global biosecurity. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian said. The United States has said it is not aware of any biological weapons programs in Ukraine. There are no Ukrainian biological weapons laboratories supported by the United States, not near Russia's borders or anywhere, said America's United Nations Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield. The U.S. has always claimed to be open and transparent, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian said. If the concerns are truly disinformation, why doesn't the United States release detailed materials to prove its innocence? Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian has claimed that the United States spent $200 million funding biological laboratories and questioned what kind of research was being conducted in Ukraine. The United States has partnered with Ukraine through the Biological Threat Reduction Program, BTRP, part of the Cooperative Threat Reduction Initiative that aims to support peaceful and safe biological detection and diagnostic capabilities and to reduce the threats posed by pathogens, according to the U.S. Department of Defense, the Pentagon. The Ukraine embassy says the Biological Threat Reduction Program, BTRP, is designed to counter outbreaks of the world's most dangerous infections. Through the Biological Threat Reduction Program, the BTRP, the United States has invested approximately $200 million in Ukraine since 2005, supporting over 40 Ukrainian laboratories, health facilities, and diagnostic sites, according to the U.S. Department of Defense, the Pentagon. The U.S. Department of Defense's CTR, or Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, began its biological work with Ukraine to reduce the risk posed by the former Soviet Union's illegal biological weapons program, which left Soviet successor states with unsecured biological materials after the fall of the former Soviet Union. The U.S. Department of Defense states in a fact sheet about the Cooperative Threat Reduction CTR program. The Pentagon claims it has partnered with many countries for its Cooperative Threat Reduction CTR program, stating even working with Russian-owned laboratories until 2014. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian questioned why U.S. officials refused to open the Ukrainian laboratories for independent research by international experts. He then accused the United States of being self-contradictory, saying the nation points fingers at other countries stating non-compliance, but then refuses to verify its own actions. This is typical double standard. Moreover, given the credibility of the United States, it is very difficult for it to win the trust of the international community, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Lijian said. The U.S. Department of State says Russia and China's conspiracy theories are only attempting to justify Moscow's hostility towards Ukraine. The Return of the Nazi. Part 2.
Each European citizen has a bank account number which can be used in any European country to access banks' transactions because of a common banking system across the EU, and the euro, which is a single currency, has made it easier for citizens to shop.
And also, the Schengen political concept allows European citizens to freely travel and specifically work in all European countries. This has caused European countries to have a shared market and also a shared labor market. When the breakneck speed of the industrial and economic growth of the US and USSR was turning the world into ashes at a time of the crazed speed of Japan's economic growth, Europe had to establish itself as an economic superpower. The euro was a dream the Europeans had to achieve. The euro, which is the common currency of the countries of the European Union, is the blood in the veins of the economies of the bloc, and Frankfurt is its economic beating heart. More than a third of Frankfurt's population is made up of migrants today. And this is how Europe's uniform and cohesive economy survived and made growth on the shoulders of its industrial giants. So much so that today the products of well-known big companies have engraved Europe in the collective memory of everyone around the world. To all of us, Europe is defined by its economy.
Which, with Britain leaving the Union, this leaves two major countries, one economic power and one strategic nuclear power, Germany and France, basically determining most of the policies of the Union and using the Union for their interests, the French interest being a player on the world scale, the German interest being to export as many BMWs to as many countries that you can imagine.
The economy was the most important reason for the formation of the bloc, but it was not the only one. If the madness of the likes of Hitler and Mussolini was supposed to be stopped from casting dark shadows over Europe again, if Europe was able to survive the shattering rivalry between the East and West, if Europe was supposed to be able to battle upcoming military and economic powers in the years to come, it had to unite. Frankfurt, which is home to the European Central Bank, is considered Europe's and Germany's economic hub. It is also where the world's, the European Union's, and Germany's largest industries are usually based or hold their exhibitions.
Different immigration histories and different reasons for being pro-immigration or against immigration. The as far as Germany is concerned, we have Germany is the economic power center of the European Union, which means that the demand for labor is still very high, which also means that Germany needs immigration because otherwise it can't grow economically. Now, it's always difficult to sell to a public that you need, let's say, 1 million immigrants a year. People do not necessarily like the idea. So then it's useful, it's helpful if you can import refugees, which have a sort of humanitarian reason to be here.
Member countries relinquished an important part of their power and national sovereignty to a huge international union and in exchange got many things. They became part of a huge and powerful political institution. The political and economic support of the bloc against new crises.
Myself as a European citizen, maybe, I don't know how these decisions have been taken. So people feel also that power has been moved away from the national countries to a European level. And this feeling of dissatisfaction also adds to the frustration that again leads to a protest vote.
Faced with the problems of today, which are immigration, refugees, terrorism, and there is a threat.
What will the fate of the European Union be? Where will extremist right movements lead it to?
For a hierarchical structure between countries. You speak of an if there is a system of countries with a center and a periphery, countries that are nominally sovereign but de facto have to follow the lead of a central power, like, for example, in the West for a long time, the American Empire, or in the East, in fact, the Russian or Soviet Empire.
But a large portion of the issues of Europe's extremist right is related to the fear of migrants. Migrants who usually come toward Europe from the north of Africa or the Middle East. A united Europe is now a huge and powerful empire again, an effective institution. This is the realization of the same sweet old dream. This time, all roads lead to Brussels. At times, the city of Brussels is considered the symbol of the European Union, especially when it comes to extremist right parties. When they want to showcase the interference of the EU in their country, they point to Brussels as the enemy. For example, they say, "We will stand up to Brussels." The reason is that Brussels is the symbol of the European Union, the headquarters of the European Parliament, and is the city in which most of the European Union's institutions are located. Wherever you see the flag of Belgium and Brussels, you see the flag of the European Union next to it. But this promised land could not remain divine forever. The man-made heaven of the Europeans had many attractions, especially for people who lived in other countries, in deprived lands, in war-stricken countries, regions grappling with droughts, places that looked nothing like Europe. If mankind had been able to create an ideal model for transnational governance after years, why shouldn't it be the right of all people to live under these circumstances? Sixty, 70 years ago, where people are sitting now and taking in the sights of Paris, German Nazi soldiers who had occupied this city were sitting. But as you can see, it very soon changed, and now tourists who are here from across Europe are here because of the European Union and its open border policy. There are also many migrants who come here and put on shows and play music. Maybe these are the causes of the French to ask themselves, why among all the people who are in the city of Paris, many are black, many are wearing hijabs, and many are foreigners? This might make him feel danger because they might not consider these people tourists and think that they are people who are living among the French and are changing France's culture. The process of migrants arriving in Europe sped up, and this itself changed the image of the continent. Europe was not white anymore. The change in the social fabric was inevitable, but it created many crises. This was the most important one, the re-emergence of a nightmare. Almost a year before the chaos surrounding Brexit, two terrorists attacked the office of Charlie Hebdo magazine, a tragedy in response to other bitter events, the harassing of Muslims, the burning of the Quran and others, tragedy alongside other bigger tragedies. A tragedy surrounding the re-emergence of nightmares, the rise of extremist right, or in other words, Europe's fundamentalists. Two main views existed in Europe's foreign policy. One was the Atlantic-leaning view, a view toward the American continent and especially the U.S. The British mostly had this view. The other one was a pan-European view, which said that the Europeans are in actuality of one nationality and race and have to have relations with one another. Our outlook should be focused on Europe. This is the viewpoint which caused the creation of the European Union. And the Atlantic-leaning view caused the exit of Britain from the Union, which is known as Brexit.
Now, if you look at the European Union, these parties are a threat. But for the moment, actually, the Brexit and the election of the Trump have consolidated the feeling that the European Union is essential. If you look at the public opinion, they are not anti-Europe. Actually, in France, the proportion of people who say we need to be united has been going up.
European countries needed a mechanism to guarantee permanent peace, a mechanism that had to simultaneously contain the infiltration of Russian communism and American imperialism, a mechanism to keep the European dream alive, and the bloc was Europe's response to this need, to keep these streets happy and safe.
And I think that for doing this, we need to restart from the very, very basic level of our all-day life, our all-day relationships, and then to rebuild a different way to do in politics, to take in the public decisions. But before, we have really to reconstruct this sense of a relationship.
The general problem of empires is that the periphery needs to be supported by the center. For example, the periphery has to make sure that the center has to make sure that the governments, the semi-autonomous governments of peripheral states, collaborate with the center. For that, you have to give them something. Now, for a while, the center of the empire can extract enough resources from the periphery to pay for its costs and even leave some profit. Now, over time, this becomes more and more difficult. And the larger an empire becomes, the more difficult it becomes. And the question that I'm raising is, for how long will Germany, and it's basically Germany, it's not France, be able to pay for the cohesion of this thing called European Union?
But now, everything is on the edge. Huge economic challenges every once in a while strike one of the member states and affect the economies of the rest of the countries. The unstoppable number of refugees creates a devastating economic and social issue every day. And the right has found an opportunity to emerge again. They believe Europe does not need to remain as one to be European. In a world in which its most powerful politician's trump card is pulling out the US from different international treaties, Europe's right parties are critical of the European Union more than anything else. Instead of sacrificing their short-term and nationality for a common, collective, huge dream. On the one hand, there was a long line of countries which wanted to join the European Union, and on the other, different countries were trying to be inspired by this unique structure and pass similar international treaties. The Arab League, the African League, and many other international organizations and treaties tried to structure themselves in a way to reach the blissful European model. A few years ago, when the European Union was at the peak of its power, Eastern European countries requested that they join the bloc. One of the most important conditions for this to happen is the economic situation in those countries. The Central Bank of Europe studies countries based on the stability of prices, exchange rate stability, GDP, and a number of other important economic indicators, and then allows these countries to become a part of the bloc. Most Eastern European countries became part of the EU, and this in turn later caused the confrontation with Russia, which exists until today. Even a country like Turkey, which has a huge part of it located in Asia, requested to become a member state, and the process took years. The Europeans had different issues with Turkey, from economic topics to human rights issues and others, and in the end, Turkey's accession to the bloc did not happen. But maybe one of the reasons was that Turkey is a Muslim-majority country, and it's neither Christian nor Western. The year 1988, and this important speech by Margaret Thatcher in Bruges, only 13 years after the days that the Iron Lady was taking part in protests in support of a referendum, today what happened to Thatcher is repeating for many other politicians. Many of them, under the shadows of the rise in the extremist right, have come to the conclusion that the bloc is not the best way to achieve the aspirations of their people. They think that a bloc, which was once created to help countries make progress and guarantee security for each other, has now turned into a heavy burden and is decreasing the speed of growth and change. The statue of Joan of Arc, the symbol of France, the leader of the French against the British in the Hundred Years' War, someone who was later captured by them and burned at the stake, but years later deemed innocent by the church and beatified. Today, Joan of Arc is the symbol of France's nationalism. This is where France's National Party gathers, and the leader of the party, Ms. Marine Le Pen, holds her gatherings and makes her speeches. Extremist parties are now slowly coming to power everywhere in Europe, With young leaders, extreme nationalist slogans, and an insatiable appetite in strengthening national sovereignty, the slogans they chant are at times like the fascist ones vocalized during the first half of the 20th century. The growing interest of the people in these parties can be the beginning of a huge crisis for the EU. Politicians who don't like the European Union have now made it to European Parliament. But today, the policies of European governments and their fragile coalitions, which have been struck because of the emergence of the extreme right, are like these locks that those in love attach to these bridges as a memorabilia. These policies are locked, and for the time being, there are no solutions for them. Maybe after Britain, it might be the turn of other countries, for example, France.
A country like France has, Britain has, but Britain and France in the same European Union didn't work because they both have nuclear arms. They both sit on the United Nations Security Council as permanent members, and since they have different interests and different regions in the world, it was always hard for them to agree to the European Union to develop a common policy. But now with Germany and France, it could be that the Germans will be willing to underwrite sort of some of the traditional French foreign policy concerns. One doesn't know.
All these events have one important reason. Today, the challenges and crises European countries are dealing with differ from what they faced in the past. Europe has been completely rebuilt and is back at the peak of development. The Security Council and NATO have for years maintained peace in Europe. The USSR has collapsed, and a force from the East does not threaten Europe anymore. But the US, with the strange policies of its most unbalanced president in its history, and China, with its most devastating trade attacks, have targeted Europe's not-so-resilient economy. Today, new dangers threaten Europe, and the bloc cannot do much in any of these instances. The same flames which are buried under the ashes of all this concrete and metal, economic crises, refugees, social gaps, anti-immigration sentiments, and extremism. Now the bloc is so overwhelmed by its internal problems that it does not even have the influence and credibility of the past. They cannot even stay fully committed to the implementation of a simple international treaty.
Great Britain have destroyed Europe and got out of it. So very, very clever decision, because they have fleet from the ship coming down. So I think that that was the reason of decline.
This is my assessment during my trips. The exit of Britain from the EU, the possible exit of some other important countries in the future, weaker European countries joining the bloc, new challenges which the bloc faces, and the people's leaning toward nationalist movements which oppose the EU, all have come together to create a not-so-bright future for this important international institute.
That is Brexit, and the other is affirmation of independence by Hungary, by Poland, and somehow by Greece. So Eastern Europe is in revolt against European.
The weakening of the strength of the European Union as one of the present era's big powerhouses makes its rivals happy. That's why Trump welcomes Brexit. Or, for example, it's for the same reason that Aaron Banks, one of the most ardent supporters of Brexit, has extensive trade relations with Russia. Competition with 28 small countries is easier than coming face to face with a big bloc. And it doesn't seem that China is too upset about the weakening of a troubled Europe either.
The Germans think that they are not Germans, they are Europeans. So everything that's good for Germany is by definition good for Europe. They don't see, they don't think they are Germanizing Europe. What they think is they are Europeanizing Europe, because they turn it into into a copy of Germany. The Americans were like that. Americans believed that everybody should be like Americans, and that was not Americanizing them, but it was humanizing the world. Yeah? And the Russians, basically, when the Sassanid Empire functioned in the same way, or the French. Yeah. So I think it's part of an imperial outlook that you think that it's good for other people to be like we are. Yeah. And it's natural for other people. You don't have to do much. You only have to give them a chance to wake up, and then they will immediately see, let's become Germans.
At least at the level of European politicians, the worries are not that deep. It doesn't seem that collapse, or at least the familiar way it happened in the East, is being expected for the European Union. It doesn't seem that we are witnessing the breakup of the bloc the way it happened to the League of Nations. Will the European Union remain intact? Will France remain in the EU?
They're not large enough to pose a serious threat to the European Union and to European integration. And certainly if the European Union is going to collapse, which I don't think is going to happen, it will be more due to internal struggles between different interests of different countries than of the role of the radical right.
So I think that the European Union as it stands today will not collapse, but it might transform, which we can see already with Brexit and phenomena related to that. And but I do not think that a Europe that is made out of independent national states.
Nearly 70 years after the Paris meeting, the Europeans only have two options. They either have to make the structure of the bloc compatible with today's world, or go back to the pre-war era, the era of dispersion, a Europe which is prone to the rise of the likes of Hitler, Franco, and Salazar, something that is not too far-fetched with the re-emergence of the extremist right.
The European Union is a unique political structure, and in order to understand it, you have to understand the individual member countries and their very complex relations with each other and with the center, and the power relations between the two most powerful states, France, Germany, who have a very complicated relationship between them. And then they also have interests with respect to the periphery, which sometimes overlap and sometimes they don't. So the complexity of this system is enormous, and that will continue. So in order to understand it, you have to really take a very hard and good look.
Will this joyous atmosphere continue? Should Europe expect more exits? How long will these stars remain in the blue sky of Europe? These are questions Europe has to answer, and an entire world is waiting for these answers.
Congratulations to everyone on the 15th of Sha'ban, the birthday anniversary of the Imam of the Age, Abu Saleh al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. Hereby, at IRIB English Radio, congratulate all Muslims on the occasion of 15th of Sha'ban, the birthday anniversary of the 12th Imam, Al-Qa'im al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance.
In the Limelight.
Neither Bush nor Rumsfeld had the legal authority to permit government agents to commit felonies, though we now know that they did, says Andrew P. Napolitano writer in an article published under the heading Military Torturers at Guantanamo Bay. Stay tuned for more. After a jury in 2006 declined to impose the death penalty on Zacharias Moussaoui, who had just pleaded guilty to being the 20th 9/11 hijacker, the government announced that another person was the 20th. Yet that person, Muhammad al-Ghahtani, was ordered released from the U.S. naval prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, recently. Here is the backstory. Moussaoui had been living in Minnesota and taking flying lessons when he was arrested in August 2001 for an immigration violation. When officials questioned him, the answers he gave aroused their suspicions about what he intended to do with a plane once he was qualified to fly. The FBI conducted a criminal investigation, and shortly after 9/11, Moussaoui was indicted in Virginia for conspiracy to commit acts of terrorism on 9/11. The government sought the death penalty. 5 years later, he pleaded guilty during his trial. The court then conducted a penalty phase trial before the same jury that had been hearing the case prior to the guilty plea. The jury declined to impose the death penalty, with some jurors revealing their beliefs that he had nothing to do with 9/11, but was a jihadi wannabe. The judge sentenced him to life in prison without possibility of parole. Stung by the jury's verdict on the death penalty, the government changed its characterization of Moussaoui on the 20th hijacker and declared that Muhammad al-Ghahtani was the real 20th hijacker. In August 21, Ghahtani had attempted to enter the United States at Orlando International Airport, where Muhammad Atta, one of the true hijackers, was waiting to greet him. Immigration officials rejected Ghahtani's paperwork and sent him back to Dubai. U.S. forces arrested him in Pakistan in December 21 and accused him of being Osama bin Laden's bodyguard. He was transferred to the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, where he was tortured for 2 months in 2002 and 2003 by the military, pursuant to orders issued by Secretary of Defense Donald H. Rumsfeld. He told his torturers what he thought they wanted to hear. His torture was so persistent and horrific that army medics were frequently called upon to prevent his death and to revive him for his frequent blackouts so that the torture could resume. When detailed logs of his torture were leaked to the media, Susan J. Crawford, President George W. Bush's emissary overseeing tortures and prosecutions at Gitmo, acknowledged publicly that we tortured him, and thus it would be impossible to try him, unquote. Recently, the U.S. government decided to release Ghahtani, whom it believes was the true 20th hijacker, to officials in Saudi Arabia. The stated reason for his release is his diminished mental capacity. The true reason is that he has become an embarrassment for the U.S. government. Gitmo prosecutors told the Bush Departments of Justice and Defense that no judge would permit a prosecution where the principal evidence against the accused was obtained from his torture. Ghahtani's case is a lesson in the clash between human rights and unbridled government. If Rumsfeld had listened to government lawyers, he would have known that the American civilian and military legal systems are based on the inalienability of certain rights and values, and among them are bodily integrity, the presumption of innocence, and the rule of law. The Supreme Court jurisprudence on bodily integrity prohibits the introduction of anything into or upon the body of any person against his will. This includes everything from face masks to whips and chains to chemicals in the veins. The rule of law in America makes the intentional infliction of pain and severe discomfort by the government upon a prisoner a felony. The horrific Bush-inspired scenario actually happened. After Bush lost at the Supreme Court, the U.S. government outsourced its torture and now finds itself as a witness in cases against the foreign torturers whom it hired to torture its prisoners. Even worse, the man jurors found was not the 20th hijacker is in prison for life, and the man the U.S. government says was the 20th hijacker will soon be free. This is what happens when the U.S. government breaks its own laws and violates the Constitution that they have hired it to uphold.
Face to face. Hello, everyone. This is Face to Face, and I'm Yusuf Jalali. Today, I'm joined by Kazem Gharibabadi, who is the secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights. Welcome to the show. Well, please tell us about the Islamic Republic's approach toward the issue of human rights. Is there a difference between the international human rights and Iran's take on the issue?
Iran is an Islamic country. Some asking the question that what is the relation between Islam and the human rights? Does Islam believe in human rights or not? And whether Islamic Republic of Iran as an Islamic country with its constitution believes in human rights or not? My question is that Islam and the Islamic Republic of Iran believe in human rights. We are of the view that human rights is rooted in religions. Several important principles regarding human rights have been emphasized by the Islamic rules and procedures more than 14 centuries ago. So that's a fact. So we are not against the human rights. This is actually the first and important point that I should make it very clear, that what is the relation between Iran and the human rights. So we are accepting the human rights. But what is our strategy towards the human rights? We are against politicization of human rights. Some are of the view that all the human rights are universal. Again, we are not against the universality of human rights. We are of the view that some principles of human rights are universal. For example, right to life is a universal right. Whether you are in Iran or in other countries, you have the right to life. And several other areas when it comes to the human rights. So universality is a principle. But whether we can impose our lifestyle when it comes to the human rights to the other countries and to impose on them a set of unified standards on human rights to the others or not, so we are against that. Because we have more than 193 countries in the international community, and each of them have their own culture, civilization, so we have to pay respect to the cultural diversity when it comes to the human rights. One clear example is, for example, the issue of the punishment in the penal codes of the countries. Some countries have death penalty, and some other countries, they do not have death penalty. We cannot impose our standards on the others that, for example, that if we do not have death penalty, you should abolish also the death penalty. First, at the first stage, we should take into consideration the particularities of the countries, why some countries have death penalty and why some countries do not have. So this is the cultural diversity that should be respected in human rights while we are considering the human rights, while we are discussing it. So it's very important. If we do not respect the cultural diversity, absolutely a debate would be emerged among the countries. Differences would be increased among the countries. So it would be very difficult to come to a common understanding on human rights because some countries are going to impose their own standards on the others. And that is against the human rights principles and procedures. So this is one of our strategies when it comes to the human rights. And this is not only Iran's view. So this is the view of developing countries and non-aligned movement countries that actually they are putting emphasis on the necessity of respecting the cultural diversity. And the second issue that we are following it up at the level of international organizations dealing with the human rights is the issue of avoiding double standard and selective approaches. Human rights is human rights. And if it is violated, it is bad everywhere. Either it is in Iran or it is in other countries. We do not have bad or good violation of human rights. But what we are witnessing is a political approach toward the human rights. The Western European countries and the United States have this selective approach, unfortunately. So the countries that are not as allies to these countries are under political pressure in the international human rights mechanisms and structures because they are going to abuse the human rights as a political tool to achieve their own foreign policy goals. And that is, again, destructive to the human rights itself. So there are several other countries that they do not enjoy democratic structures. They have not seen in their own lifetime even one election, but they are very immune from being criticized at the international organization. But the countries that they have these structures in place, and the people play an important role in their own destiny. So those countries are being criticized in the international human rights structure. So these are some important elements what we are discussing the human rights. So, the Iran's strategy towards the human rights first is engagement. What do we mean by engagement? We are a member to several important international human rights treaties. So we are implementing our obligations. We are reporting to the treaty bodies the implementation of the provisions of the conventions periodically. Just last year, we have presented two reports to two treaty bodies in Geneva regarding implementation of two important human rights conventions. We have our own contacts and dialogues with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. We have very good relations with several thematic special rapporteurs. We are responding to the communication that we are receiving from human rights procedures. So our policy is based on engagement. This is the first pillar of our policy. And the second pillar of our policy is to have a proactive policy and approach towards the human rights. Some name it as an offensive policy, but I name it as a proactive policy. You know, what do I mean by proactive? Is that human rights does not mean that countries like Iran should always respond to the others' claims and allegations. Human rights is violated tremendously and excessively in countries like European countries and the United States and even Canada and Israeli regime. So who has the responsibility to bring these issues in the context of the international human rights structures? They are very safe and immune. Our policy, Iran's policy, is to highlight the violation of human rights in these countries that they claim that they are at the forefront of protecting human rights, and that's not true. So we are investing in this area to highlight the violation of the human rights in these countries. And the third pillar of our policy and strategy is to highlight and to promote the human rights at the domestic level, to promote and to protect the human rights. We are not against that. A chapter in our constitution has been allocated only to the rights of the nation, chapter 3 of the constitution. So we are protecting and promoting the rights of the people at the domestic level, and simultaneously our policy is to promote and to explore the achievements in the way of protecting and promotion of human rights at the global level.
All right. Recently, as the Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, you attended the UN Human Rights Council meeting and you delivered a speech there. What was the mission assigned to the Iranian delegation there, and what was the final output of the meeting?
The meeting of the Human Rights Council is still continued in Geneva, and it will be finalized in 2 weeks. But by the way, I have been there in the high-level segment of the Human Rights Council. So I have highlighted several important areas before the Human Rights Council. The first was the policy of Iran towards the human rights. I made it very clear to the Human Rights Council that our policy is promotion and protection of human rights, not only at the domestic level, but also for the other countries. And also I made it very clear that our policy would be based on engagement with international human rights structure. That was the first message that I delivered it. The second was regarding the areas of violation of human rights against Iranian nation. And I highlighted two important areas, terrorism and sanction through the unilateral coercive measures. I told the room that during past 4 decades after our Islamic Revolution, 1979, more than 17,000 of Iranian innocent people have lost their life due to the terrorist operations by the terrorist groupless that now are living in European countries in the safe havens. And I asked the room, and specifically the European countries, to respond to this contradictory approach, that they claim that they are against the terrorists and terrorism, but they are hosting the terrorist groups in the European countries and their own territories. So that was the first. And the second area of violation is the unilateral sanctions. And also I made it very clear that Iranian nation are under the strongest area of unilateral sanctions that are imposed, unfortunately, by the United States of America. And this is against the Charter of the United Nations, against the international law, international human rights law. So I asked the room that you are pretending, some of you pretending, that you are going to protect and support the Iranian nation's human rights. Because of this, they have appointed a special rapporteur for Iran. And they are issuing 2 resolutions annually in Geneva and New York against Iran. So if you are pretending that you are going to protect the rights of Iranian nation, why you are violating the rights of Iranian nation through terrorism and also through the sanctions? So this is very important. So I made it very clear to the room. And the next issue was the politicization of human rights that I talked about it. The issue of Yemen and issue of Palestine also has been highlighted in my statement. So we have touched actually several important issues in the high-level segment. Yemen, Palestine, politicization of human rights, our objection against the appointment of the special rapporteur and issuing the resolutions against Iranians, the issue of sanctions, the issue of terrorism. So these issues have been discussed. And I believe that was very important to deliver the messages directly to the countries.
Well, you touched on the issue of Yemen. And let's talk about this in more details.